This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Judging by my social media feed, this past weekend marked the tipping point in the harvest. I saw so many photos of snow peas and kale and lettuce. I actually picked my first few cucumbers, ate a few tomatoes straight off the vine, grilled my first batches of broccoli, and pickled some cauliflower. And I restrained myself only one Instagram of the pickles. So now that we're well into the season, it's time to get your questions answered about your gardens and what perhaps is going wrong. Our favorite garden guru, Charlie Nardozzi, is back to answer all of your head scratchers about varmints and blight and weeds and weather. You can call 1-800-639-2211 to ask a question of Charlie. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Charlie, great to see you.
Nice to be here, Jane.
All right, so what else are people harvesting now? What's going on in the garden?
Oh,
right,
it's all exploding, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. So the cool season crops are kind of winding down, the lettuces, the peas that you mentioned, the radishes. And so I always like to mention at this time of year, this is a great opportunity to start yanking a lot of those things out. Don't be a soft-hearted gardener. If you've got a few peas still hanging on there, a few lettuces still looking okay, yank them all out, because it's going to give you an opportunity to plant for the fall, which is what we really want to be doing now in July, planting some kale, maybe a fall crop of carrots, maybe a fall crop of lettuce. So that would be a nice thing to start doing right now in the garden, is to start looking towards the September, October, November timeframe when you can get some more things growing in your garden. But all those warm season crops are going to start really coming in now. If you haven't started getting tomatoes yet, peppers, the cucumbers and the squashes, sweet potatoes seem to like grow overnight. They went from these little plants to like a total big ground cover on the bed. So all that's happening, it's very exciting in the garden. It's just great. Every day you go out there, something new is going on. And of course, something eating them is going on too. So there's plenty of beetles out there, and the blights with this humid weather are really picking up their pace as well. So lots of things happening out there.
Yeah, so you could spend a lot of time trying to keep your garden in check.
Yes, exactly. And if you've been really on top of it as far as weeding and stuff, that at least will be one thing you don't have to worry so much about. If you've been mulching and weeding pretty diligently by now, you know, most of those weeds have kind of slowed down their growth and you're not getting a big flush. If you didn't do that, well, you might have a little jungle on your hand.
Yeah, I have a jungle anyway. I have a hard time just keeping the plants themselves in check. I feel like my tomatoes, I mean, it just feels like it's a rainforest when I walk into the garden.
Yeah, they grow very quickly. And if you're growing those indeterminate types, like a lot of the heirlooms, most of the heirlooms are indeterminate, you can make them a little more compact, restrain their growth a little bit by snipping off the suckers. And that's a good thing to do. Starting this time of year, any of those new suckers that are forming towards the top of the plant, just snip them off with your hands as you're going through the garden. That'll keep the plant a little more in balance. And it'll help that fruit that's maturing mature a little faster.
So if you're starting to see some new flowers on the plant, now would be a time to clip those as
well?
Oh,
no, not the flowers.
Or just keep the flowers?
Jane, let's not push it too fast. It is only July. No, the flowers are fine. You'll still be able to get flowers and fruit that are starting this time of year. It's really those suckers, which are the ones between the main stem and the side leaf branch, they're going to take a while to form an actual stem that will flower and fruit. And by the time that happens, it'll be well into September and you probably won't get mature fruit from them. So starting in July, middle of July or so, is a good time to snip those new suckers off, because they won't have enough time to grow out and produce fruit.
Got it. And if you're planting something like broccoli, if you've planted that and you're starting to get a harvest now, you know, some things will actually have more harvest if you cut the broccoli now. Can you get more broccoli heads, or should you pull them and plant new broccoli?
Oh, no, keep the broccoli coming. I particularly love having broccoli heads in the garden, because once you get that main head, you get all the side shoots coming. And there are certain varieties that are better at side shoots than others, the Italian heirlooms like DeSico. So keep those coming, and you'll get those right into November, maybe depending upon our weather, right through a killing frost. So it's nice to have that, as long as the plant stays healthy. Now, sometimes when you cut that main head off, if you don't cut it on an angle, you'll get an area where there'll be a lot of water in there, and you start getting a rot disease, especially a bacterial rot disease that really stinks. Then, it stinks.
Yeah, yum. Sounds great.
And so that one, those you'll have to really yank out. But otherwise, let the broccoli keep coming.
All right. Well, let's talk about broccoli. We got a couple of emails about it,
okay,
and specifically one about that stinky rot that you've been talking about. Peggy says, we have a black crud that's killing our broccoli, and it stinks and rots the stem. We had some last year, so I planted the broccoli in an entirely new place. twice, but we got this again, and I never saw it happen until these past couple of years. Peggy says, broccoli is our best plant, especially for the freezer. Please help.
Oh. Yes, yeah, so it probably is that disease. It's a bacterial disease versus a fungal disease, and you can tell because of that smell that's on there. I think it may be an Erwinia botanically. It doesn't really matter too much what the botanic name is of it, but what you want to do is look for some varieties. Next year, do a little snooping in some of the catalogs like High Mowing and Johnny's and look for some that are more disease-resistant, specifically against those bacterial blights that will attack broccoli. That will be one thing you want to do. Grow it in raised beds if you haven't already so that it has really well-drained soil. That will help. And then again, just like I was mentioning, when you do cut that main head off, try to do it at an angle a little bit so that any water that comes down with rain or when you're watering will go off of the plant and not sit there and be a nice breeding ground for that disease to get started.
But nothing she can do this year?
This year, no. Now, once it's gotten to the stage of black crud, that's a technical term, there's probably not much you want to do. I think you probably want to pull it out and do a fall crop of broccoli in a different location.
Okay. And then on another broccoli question, Lance says, my broccoli seedlings are very long and spindly. They're growing at right angles and they lack thickness. I started them from seeds outdoors and this seems to occur every year and the yield is minimal. So any suggestions?
Well, if he's direct sowing them outdoors, sometimes that will happen that they get shaded, they get stressed in some way. So I would suggest next year to actually start them as seedlings indoors. Even this time of year, I've already started my cauliflower, which I like to grow as a fall crop. I did that maybe 3 weeks ago, and I started them all indoors and been growing them indoors, just moved them out to harden off now. And that way you can really monitor and make sure they get enough sunlight, they get the intensity of light so they don't get that stretching that'll happen if they're growing outside and they're getting shaded or we go through a cloudy stretch where they don't get enough light. And once they get leggy, they can't get unleggy. they don't get stocky. So once you have them leggy, it's going to be like that for their entire life. So I would suggest starting with seedlings next time.
And could he pull them now and get a fall crop in?
Well, it's trying to start seedlings this late. It's going to be really risky because it's getting a little bit late in the season. If you can find a really quick maturing variety of broccoli in particular, you might be able to try it, get it growing fast, get it in the garden and protect it from those cabbage worms and other insects too.
Or maybe check the garden centers. A lot of sales going on now from garden centers who want to get rid of their plants.
Yes, the garden centers that might have some. And some of the garden centers, more forward-thinking ones, do plant some seedlings for a fall harvest now. So you can get things like broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage to transplant into your garden. And the time to do that would be by the end of July for most areas so that you can get a harvest in September.
We're talking with Charlie Nardozzi. He is giving us his gardening advice. He is a garden consultant too. So if you want more Charlie and don't want everybody to hear all of the bad things that are happening in your garden, you can always check vpr.net. We have his website up so you can find more about Charlie there. But let's go to some of our calls. And listeners, if you have a question, the number is 1-800-639-2211. Chris is calling in from Richmond. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Hi, thanks for taking my call, Charlie. I'm a big fan.
Oh, great. Thanks.
My question is about peas. I've been growing both shell peas and snap peas for a few years, and some years they do great, and then some years like this, they barely get started, and then they're done. I don't think my shell peas have gotten more than a foot off the ground. What am I doing wrong?
Huh. Are you starting them pretty early?
Starting them as early as I can. I actually had to replant some of them this year because they never came up.
Yeah, okay. Because, you know, as you know, peas are a cool season crop. So when you get these spells of hot, humid weather that we get, they really don't like it. And so the key with peas is to try to get them up and growing as fast as possible to get them to that flowering and fruiting stage. And then if we get some hot weather, they'll kind of do okay. But if they don't get to that stage before it gets hot, they don't produce much at all. So I would suggest, first of all, you still have time to grow peas, and you can definitely grow them as a fall crop. And you can, if you seed them by, I'd say, around the end of July or so. And I like to use those flat potted peas, the snow peas, because those, even if we get an early frost or an early cold spell, you still have those little peas that you can harvest and eat them. You don't have to wait for them to fill out.
Mm-hmm.
And so the pea season isn't over yet. We're just in an interlude of pea season. So you can plant those at the end of July. And I think next year, for next spring, you might want to make sure you pre-soak your seeds overnight so you get them to actually swell and start germinating, and then make sure you have a raised bed, plant them in there, and try to get them up and growing as fast as possible. And that's usually going to be the thing that's going to determine how well they do. And of course, the weather too. If we have a cool spring and cool early summer, you get a tremendous pea crop. If it's really hot, really early, then it'll be less so.
All right. Good luck with that, Chris. And maybe if you do get a fall crop, you can call in when we have a fall gardening show and
let us know how it goes.
Yeah, I want to hear. Let's go to Susan in Pittsfield. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Charlie. Hi, Jane. Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. I always love the gardening show. I'm actually calling not about an edible, but about my honeysuckle. I have a beautiful honeysuckle hedge that I inherited, so it's been here for at least 20 years. And the last couple of years, it greens out really beautifully in the springtime, and it flowers gorgeously. And then once it's flowered, the tops of, it seems like the new growth starts to look like it looks burned. It's not in good shape. And yesterday on a hike with some friends, I saw a honeysuckle down the road from us in the same condition. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if, Charlie, do you know what this is and, you know, what I might be able to do to remedy it and turn it around?
Yeah, I would check the new growth and see if you see any insect activity on there. I mean, it sounds more like a disease than an insect, but it's always good to kind of check it, look at on the undersides of the leaves, see if you can see any kind of, especially some smaller insects, aphids and thrips and things like that that'll go after honeysuckle. But it could very well just be a blight disease. And we get this humid weather that comes in and it loves that nice succulent new growth on the honeysuckle early in the season. And it's really moist and that's the perfect conditions for a fungal disease to attack it. So as far as preventing it, I mean, you could do sprays, but it sounds like this is a pretty big hedge. So I'm not sure you're going to want to be spraying the whole hedge. That might be a little more involved. But pruning it and thinning it out a little bit so you get more air circulation inside that hedge, that might help a little bit too. Honeysuckles are a tough plant, so you can really cut them back pretty severely and they'll regrow pretty quickly. And if you're seeing a lot of this damage there, you might be worth cutting them back a little bit, get some new growth growing in there and see if that does any better.
Speaking of cutting things back, is it too late to cut back your lilac now? You've talked before, Charlie, about how you want to cut back right after the bloom because they set blossoms for the following year. They set the buds pretty early.
Right. You've got 6 to 8 weeks. So if you do the math, you're right on the edge. So if you're thinking of cutting back your lilac or your forsythia or your spirea, any of those spring blooming shrubs, rhododendron, you need to do it like right now, right after the show.
Yes, wait 45 minutes.
Wait 45 minutes, then go out there and prune because you're really at that edge. They are setting their flower buds very soon for next year.
And remind us, in these different shrubs and different crops, do you have to, when you're cutting back, what do you have to know about the plant to know the best way to cut it back?
Well, when you're looking at shrubs, flowering shrubs, there's two different kinds. There's ones that bloom on old wood and there's ones that bloom on new wood. So the ones that bloom on old wood, the ones I just mentioned, you want to cut those back right after they're done blooming or within the 6 to 8 week window. The ones that bloom on new wood, like Rose of Sharon or Buddleias or Clethoras, those you prune in the spring to actually stimulate more new growth because you want to have a lot of new growth because that's where you're going to get more flowers from. So first thing you have to determine is which kind of plant you have. And then after that, when you're pruning them, you have to kind of decide, is it the kind of plant that I can really whack back like a forsythia or a lilac and it'll just sprout back up? Or is it more like a yew or a juniper where you cut it way back and it's never going to look really good. You know, it takes years to recover from it. So you have to kind of know how far you can cut these shrubs in back so you don't go too far with them and then you have something that looks like a grotesque movie or something.
So do a little research before you get your clippers out.
Exactly.
All right. Let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Walden. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. Great show. Love to listen to it every day.
Oh, thanks.
A comment and a question. The caller who called in about the honeysuckle, she might want to check with the master gardener about whether it's an invasive honeysuckle or a native. And because honeysuckle is the invasive honeysuckle is a problem in Vermont. My question is, what is the insect that is making holes in my bok choy and kale leaves, and what would be the remedy?
Bob, boy, you know, you're not alone. I think you and Pat in Spofford, New Hampshire have the same problem. Pat wants to know what's eating kale. Pat says, I've never had any previous predators gobbling my kale in my garden. I have hung old CDs above the plants, but I guess the perps don't like my taste in music. So Bob and Pat both wondering what the heck is eating their
kale. What's eating the kale and the bok choy? Well, it depends on the holes. So if it looks like someone took a a little baby shotgun to your plants and has this spattering of little holes all over the leaves, that's most likely flea beetles. And you usually see those a little earlier in the season. But if you didn't catch them then, or if you're a little bit later getting plants in, they're still around. Once your plants are big enough, they're usually not a problem. But especially on smaller kale and bok choy plants, they will cause a lot of damage. So if it's those little holes that look like shotguns, that's probably flea beetles. If it seems more like a munching, like they're actually taking big pieces of the leaf off, it could, on the kale at least, could be cabbage worms. This time of year, you see that little white butterfly fluttering around, laying eggs, and there are cabbage worms on anything in that cabbage family. Broccoli, cauliflower, kale, cabbages, anything in that family are going to have these cabbage worms, little green worms, and you can do a number of things to control them. You can check on the undersides of the leaves for the little translucent little white eggs, and you can just smash those, or just smash the little green worms if you're not too squish about that. Or you can spray Bacillus thuringiensis, which is Dipal or Thuricide, it's the brand names. That's a bacteria that's very specific to that caterpillar family, and it'll kill just that caterpillar that's on the kale or the bok choy. For the flea beetles, I've had success with diatomaceous earth, which is a dust. And they don't really seem to like the dustiness of it. And you just kind of dust your plants with it, and they will leave the plants alone. And like I said, once the plant gets big enough, it usually is not much of a problem.
So you dust it right on the top of the plant,
right,
even though the seeds go under, I mean, the little eggs go underneath?
Well, the flea beetles are a little bit different than the cabbage worms.
Oh, I see. So that's for the worms. It won't help you with the beetles.
Right. The spray I mentioned is really just for the cabbage worms.
Got it.
For the flea beetles, we're really going to want to have a dust or something else in there that will attack those.
Got it.
Yeah.
All right. We're talking today with Charlie Nardozzi, our favorite garden friend who can help us out with all of the garden problems we're having. And so many of you do have wonderful gardens, but also have those little problems that just get your goat. So if you have a question for Charlie about what's going wrong in your garden, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You know, if you just want to gloat, you can post a picture of your garden on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, and we can all ooh and ah over that. More to come with Charlie in just a moment. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and I'm speaking today with Charlie Nardozzi. It's our midsummer gardening show, and he is helping to answer your questions about what's happening in your garden and things that you might like to do a little bit differently, whether it's figuring out what to plant for a fall crop or whether or not you can salvage a fruit or a vegetable that's not doing so well in your garden right now. If you have a question, you can post it at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Or you can call us 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. I invited people to share photos of their beautiful gardens on our Facebook page, Charlie. And I always feel like you must have a garden where nothing goes wrong. We should just walk in and there are no insects. You've got no rabbits in your yard that are eating your anything. It just must be beautiful, right?
It's paradise, really.
Yeah, that's how I picture it.
Don't come over to my house.
Like what?
We have our share of problems for sure. And this year, Japanese beetles, and even though I've done the nematodes and all of that, they still have come out in force. And we were just mentioning during the break, it seems like overnight. I went away this weekend and my couple cherry trees, smaller cherry trees I had, looked fine. And I came back and they're almost defoliated. They had so many beetles on them. So it really depends on where you are. I've heard talk to other people say, I don't have any beetles this year. It's like, can I move to where you live?
So gardeners should take heart, even if you're armed with all the knowledge of Charlie Nardozzi, you may still have problems.
You're still going to have problems. That's the beauty of gardening. You know, every year it's a little bit different, and there's always something out there that's a challenge. So I'm trying to stay organic with Japanese beetle control. And one of the things I'm going to be experimenting with is using the diatomaceous earth, like I mentioned on the flea beetles, on my grapes, as well as kale and clay, which a lot of apple growers will use to keep insects and some diseases off of their trees. Often when you go by apple orchards this time of year, you'll see the trees are kind of whitish, and that's that kale and clay that they spray on the surface. So I'm going to experiment with that and see what we can do. But certainly if you have Japanese beetles and you have just a few plants, you can handpick them. It's a great meditative thing to do first thing in the morning. Go out there, drop them in a pail of soapy water. If you're going to use the traps, make sure the trap's a couple hundred yards away from, 100 feet away from your plants that they really like, so you don't lure them in, so to speak. And then you can use sprays like neem oil, and some of the pyrethrum sprays would work on them. You start getting into the pyrethrums and the spinosads and those sprays, though, they're more broad spectrum and they can be toxic to honeybees. So there's definitely a trade-off when you start spraying some of those kinds of sprays. So that's why I'm going to try some of these dusts and see if they work.
Well, I think people have been heeding your advice and hearing you on the Japanese beetles, because we got a couple of emails from listeners about them, both of whom seem to have thought thoroughly about their questions and about what you might say. Because Mary Ellen says, you know, what can you use to get rid of the Japanese beetles? Mm-hmm. She's finding them even on her rhubarb leaves, young evergreens, hibiscus. She wants to get them taken care of before their future grubs, but she has taken your advice, she says, and spread beneficial nematodes in June.
Yes.
And then Mary says, is there another method to get rid of them? Must I pull them off by hand? Yuck.
Well, they do have a defense mechanism. Especially early in the morning, if you go out with a pail, like a shallow pan of soapy water, and just put it underneath the plant and shake the plant, they will just roll and drop. And that's their defense mechanism. And if you do it early in the morning, instead of rolling, dropping, and flying away, they'll just roll and drop right into your pail of soapy water.
So then you don't have to
You don't have to touch them. Then
Good.
They can just float around a while, and then they'll die, and then you can get rid of them. But the beneficial nematodes does work. But if you, depending upon your situation, like in my case, I'm in a hay field, so I think there's just a lot of beetles out there. You do have to spray repeatedly. And so the time to do that would be in June. And then you have a second opportunity, end of August, early September, to kill the babies of the ones that are breeding right now. So it's definitely a multi-prong approach with Japanese beetles, doing some nematodes, doing some hand picking, maybe trying some sprays. And of course, the last resort would be covering plants. And that's another option, of course, is getting some floating row cover, put it over your prized rose or some plants that you're trying to protect.
We got a note from Ray in Bakersfield who says, I don't know if it would help your previous caller, but I have found that bok choy makes a great lure for slugs to keep them off other plants. They seem to prefer it over just about anything else. And our producer, Patty, says, boy, that's a Machiavellian garden strategy. You're sacrificing one plant for the benefit of the other.
It's called trap cropping, actually. It's not as elaborate as Machiavellian, but it is used. You can get certain plants that are more attractive to a pest, stick them over in the corner somewhere, let them devour it, and then, or you can just spray them and control them and on that plant.
Let's go to Walter, who is calling in from Ripton. Hi, Walter. Go ahead.
Hi. I help run the Mount Abe Garden in Bristol, and we have purslane covering our entire garden. What organic control can we use?
I think healthy, hungry young men. Purslane is inedible, and you can actually buy varieties of purslane to grow in your garden as a vegetable. So one option is to harvest it. The other is it's growing from seed that's in your garden. So one of the most important things is not to let it go to flower. So if you start seeing it go to flower, somehow cut it down, knock it down. Don't let it set more seed into the garden. And then this fall, I would suggest doing some nice cover cropping, probably with some winter rye or a mix of oats and peas and rye build up the soil fertility in that soil. And sometimes that will actually help with some of the weed prevention too. So it's going to have to be a kind of a number of different things to do. And the next spring, instead of tilling everything under, try to go more towards a no-tilling method. Because when you till, you bring those weed seeds right up to the surface, and especially the little purslane seeds. If they get to that soil surface and they get enough light, they'll germinate and they'll grow. And then you get that problem all over again.
All right. So it may be a multi-pronged approach that includes going all the way through till next spring to
exactly.
get rid of the problem. All right. Montana's calling in from Waterbury. Hi, Montana. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Charlie. I've
sure.
gone to a couple of your workshops, and they were fabulous at Gardener Supply.
Oh, thank you.
I enjoy your spirit. So this is a question that I have for you. I am inundated with grasshoppers, and I have been for the last few years. I live in the woods. I don't use any kinds of sprays because I have pickerel frogs and toads and creatures that I'm trying to protect that are dwindling, actually. That's another part of the question. I haven't seen very many butterflies or moths or bees this year at all. I'm up on Camel's Hump Road about 1,100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to add to that problem.
Right.
But
sure.
Montana, you want to get rid of the grasshoppers specifically?
Yeah, the grasshoppers are the things that are all over the place. I have a Japanese beetle or two that I'm able to pick off up, and the red lily beetles, which I have been able to pick off, but the grasshoppers are horrible.
All right,
the
Charlie.
Slugs are, too.
Yeah. All the slugs, you're right.
Yeah. So what should she do about grasshoppers? Well, those are edible, too.
Those are edible, too. Exactly. See, there's a lot of things you can eat out there. Are these grasshoppers like an annual thing, or is it just this year?
Annual.
You're seeing? Oh, it's annual. Okay. There is a bait that you can buy. It's called Nolo, N-O-L-O, I think, a bait that you can buy. And it's kind of like what I talked about, the beneficial nematodes for the grubs of the Japanese beetles. This one kind of works a similar magic on the grubs or the immature stages of grasshoppers. So that might be one organic way to try to control them. And again, I think that's something you'd spray on the lawn areas or on the cultivated areas where you can parasitize them so you don't have as big a generation next year. And other than that, again, it's just a matter of trying to trap them, or you can try to spray them, but it sounds like you want to avoid all sprays because of concerns with the butterflies and other wildlife that you have around there. So it's really going to be more of a handpicking, maybe trying to lure them in with some trap crops and spreading this Nolo bait around to try to kill them and reduce the population for the future.
Charlie, I haven't heard much about grasshoppers being a real problem in gardens. Are
it's
they?
It's usually not in Vermont. It's more, excuse me, it's more of a Midwestern problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if we get the right conditions, you can see them coming through. You know, if you're killing your garden, you're turning your garden under a lot, that's usually not too much of a problem. It's more when you have like wheat fields and places
right.
where they can really multiply quickly and spread in hordes in biblical portions.
Yeah, which luckily we have not seen
we don't
much
see that
of
happen
here.
Yeah, right.
We're talking today with Charlie Nardozzi. We're talking gardens in the middle of the season here. So many of you harvesting things right now, looking ahead to fall crops. And if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Carol wrote in to say, my strawberries produced a lot of fruit for about 2 weeks straight, but now I have nothing. Will I get any more strawberries this year?
Seems like
the end of the season, right?
Yeah, not if she has what we call the June-bearing strawberries, which are the ones that produce for a couple weeks in June, and then they're kind of done for the season. There are a whole other class of strawberries called the ever-bearing that you'll see often around in farmers markets and grocery stores, and those will continue to produce through the season. So I think if she wants to have more strawberries, she's so happy about her strawberries, that to plant some of those ever-bearing varieties so she has a combination of some June bearers and some ever-bearers so she'll have a continual harvest of strawberries.
Ray in Hinesburg wants to know how to get parsnips to germinate. Mm-hmm. Even with fresh seeds, the germination rate is very low.
Yeah, it's a tough one to get growing. It's kind of sad. This is one of those ironies of nature because you've seen all the poison parsnip, the cow parsnip on the sides of roads all over Vermont, especially in the Champlain Valley, and it seems to have no trouble germinating.
Yeah, no
everywhere. But then you try to grow it in your garden, and it is related to that same parsnip. It just has a hard time growing. So I think the keys with I've found with them is to make sure you have a really loose soil. Use a little dibble or a little almost like a pencil or something that's going to make an indentation in the soil. And don't plant them too deep because if you plant them too deep, it'll take a long time for them to actually come through. And keep them well watered and be very patient with them. They could take up to 14 days to actually get some germination. So by keeping them well watered, not planting them too deep, hopefully you'll get, and using fresh seed, like you mentioned, that would be the best keys to getting your parsnips to grow.
All right, from parsnips to radishes. Mike can't seem to grow radishes. He mm-hmm. says, I get spindly ends, no radishes. I've thinned them to no avail. The soil grows great lettuce, peas, carrots, beets, almost everything else, but I can't get any radishes. The soil was also tested by UVM, and it has too much phosphate, which Mike says he's trying to correct. But any suggestions for growing radishes?
Well, he hit the topic of thinning, which is really the key thing with radishes, to make sure you thin them. I'm not sure if he's thinned them early enough. That's a lot of, sometimes people wait till they get big and they think, oh, it looks like it's all crowded. Maybe I should thin them now. And it's kind of too late to do it. So really, you should be thinning them once those true leaves start forming, which are the second set of leaves that'll come out once it germinates through the ground, and thinning them out to a couple inches apart. So doing it early, that'll be important. Keeping them well watered. Plant really early too. You know, as soon as you get an opening in April, end of April, even early May, get those seeds in there because you want to get the harvest happening before it gets too warm. Because once it gets warm, that's another stressor for them and it'll just send up a flower stalk.
All right. David's calling in from Fairfax. Hi, David. You're on.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a problem with moles. I put down Milky Spore last year. And of course they move, but now I actually have them in my garden where I didn't have them before. And I'm not sure if there's something organic that I can do to get rid of them. I've resorted to just setting out mouse traps with pepperoni, which actually does work, but it's one at a time kind of a thing.
Yeah. Oh, you got the Italian moles, I guess. Huh? So first of all, are you sure they're moles and not voles? So moles will be the ones that tunnel underground, leave little mounds by their entrance and exit holes, whereas voles will be more towards the surface of the soil.
Yeah. Do you have any sense, David?
I'm not sure. I mean, I got one in a trap. It is. I guess I don't know the difference. It has the starred nose to it.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah. I was going to say, if it has that kind of funny face, that starred nose, that's a mole, definitely a mole. So moles and voles don't like the smell of castor oil. In particular, the
Who
stuff...
Who does?
Some people do, I think. Maybe the castor plant does. But don't get the stuff in the grocery store. Go to a garden center and get the castor oil that's full strength, and then spray that in your garden. It won't harm anything else. It'll have a smell to it, and you won't like it very much, but it'll dissipate pretty quickly. But the moles and voles certainly will not like it, and they'll get very agitated. So for a week or so afterwards, you'll see a lot of activity, but then they will take off and head over to your neighbors, and you'll be all done.
Yes, and then you just have to maybe pay off
And then
off
you give them
neighbors.
A gift at Christmas time.
Right, exactly. We got a note from Linda, who has some advice on Japanese beetles, which we were talking about a little earlier. She says, for those who have chickens, use a shallow container with about 1.5 inches of clean water, no soap. Knock, shake, or plop the beetles into the water. When you're done, put the container in reach of your chickens. They will pick the beetles out of the water, and even if the beetles bunch up or fall to the ground, they're so disoriented, the chickens usually get them all.
There you go.
Yeah, another chickens. Way, circle of life there.
A circle of life,
feed.
And you never have to touch anything.
We're talking with Charlie Nardozzi. He is a gardening expert. He's also a gardening consultant. We have a link to his webpage at vpr.net. And if you have a question for him now while he is here with us, you can call 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and I'm here today with Charlie Nardozzi. Always a pleasure to have Charlie back, our gardening expert. This is sort of a mid-season gardening show. We are taking stock of what's happened in the garden this spring, early summer, and looking ahead to fall, looking ahead to what else we might be harvesting or what we could even start growing right now to have a great fall crop. And if you have a question for Charlie, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're also asking for those of you who are justifiably proud of your harvest or of your garden, go ahead and post a photo of it on our Facebook page. So we can all gloat, and maybe some of us can grit our teeth in jealousy. Let's go now to Loranne, who's calling in from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Loranne. Go ahead.
Hello. I want to talk about potato beetles.
Okay.
I have a plot in the community garden here, and so it's new, but I put a lot of organic compost and organic fertilizer in it, and I think people probably grown potatoes there for years, but all of a sudden it's inundated. And I can't pick them off fast enough. I tried diatomaceous earth, and that didn't seem to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And people have suggested putting wood ashes on or molasses.
Well, you know, one thing you could do, Loranne, is go to our Facebook page, find Rebecca. She's also wondering about potato bugs, and the two of you can form a little support group. But
oh,
Charlie may have some suggestions for both of you.
I do. So potato beetles, you can get the Colorado version or the smaller old-fashioned version, but they're both potato beetles, and they are on potatoes and tomatillos and eggplants and lots of different related plants within there. Now, if you're getting an explosion of a population of them, one of the first things you want to do is turn over the leaves and crush those eggs. You'll see clusters of orange eggs on the undersides of the leaves. That's where it all starts. So you want to crush those. If you can break that cycle of what's going on within the generation, that's going to slow down their onset. Then also you can spray the larval stage, those red, fat, fluffy little things that they're munching away, the young, you might say, with a form of BT. We talked earlier in the show about a BT dipel that's used for cabbage worms. Well, there's a form of it called San Diego. It's called Colorado potato beetle beater or a number of different trade names that is, again, just specific for the Colorado potato beetle. So that would be a safe one to use in your garden. It's an organic spray. It only kills the larval forms. It doesn't kill the adult, but also you're trying to break that cycle of the life cycle of those potato beetles. So doing that will definitely help. The other thing that's a little solace for you is that potatoes can lose up to a third of their foliage and still give you a good crop. So even though you might have tons of potato beetles out there and it seems like a lot of it's defoliated, don't give up on your crop. You might still have a lot of magic happening under the ground.
So do you just have to wait? Or can you check somehow to see?
You can always check.
So just dig down a little,
pull a few little new potatoes out. Yeah. It's still early for potatoes. And hopefully she hasn't gotten them so defoliated that they're not going to grow a little bit more before they give it up for the season.
Charlie, we were talking earlier about, you were saying in your garden this year, you've got just suddenly, all of a sudden, while you were away, some uninvited guests came in. Right. The Japanese beetles. But you also this year have started seeing a leek moth first time in your garden?
Yes. And first time in my garden, but certainly a lot of other fellow gardeners, colleagues have mentioned it everywhere from Grand Isle all the way down through the Burlington area. It's a new insect. Of course, it's going after something we always thought was safe, like leeks and onions and garlic, which is kind of sad. But it came out of Canada a number of years ago. It's kind of moved across the border into New York State. Now it's in Vermont. And it's kind of working its way through Vermont. So you're starting to see signs of it. It is a little caterpillar. And this time of year, you'll see it either within the hollow stems of an onion. If you look at the onion, you open it up, you'll see a little caterpillar tunneling away in there, or actually burrowing away in the center of a leek, or on some garlic scapes too, and on garlic leaves. If you see it early in the season, May, June, it's usually not too much of a problem as far as a big production for garlic and for onions. But it really, the concern is more when you get it this time of year. If you see it in July and August and you have garlic still in the garden, or you have leeks that, of course, you want to leave into the fall, or onions that are going to be maturing later, they'll start actually burrowing down into the plant itself and they can destroy those. So,
oh, how sad.
It's really sad. So you can spray, again, this Dipel because it is a caterpillar-type family insect, but you'll have to be really diligent about doing it. The best thing to do is what friends of mine have done is that they cover their garlic plants. So they plant them in the spring and they cover them with a floating row cover and they grow them just under the cover. And that works really well because they can't, of course, lay their eggs in there.
Yeah, garlic is one of my favorite things to grow because it's just so pleasing in the spring to have something green coming up.
Yeah,
it's like the rhubarb and the garlic. You start to see at the same time and it's just so wonderful. I got really distracted though this summer and I didn't pick my scapes. I didn't cut my scapes until this weekend. Am I going to have tiny little garlic bulbs because the energy has all been going to the scapes?
No, it does take some energy away, but if you have fertile soil and the plants were growing strong, a lot of leaves, you'll still get a good size garlic bulb and good sized cloves. And if you are concerned about the leek moth too, if you do have onions and garlic, it's better to harvest them a little early. So if you're starting to see signs of them like I am, so I'll be harvesting our garlic pretty soon because we don't want to let it get in there and destroy the bulb underground.
I have one other question for you from my garden. I'm going to take host prerogative here.
Oh, sure.
So we had just a bumper crop of tomatoes last year, and I will admit that some of the tomatoes fell to the ground and stayed there until we tilled them under. And I noticed when I was weeding earlier this spring that I was starting to see a couple of volunteer tomatoes.
Yeah.
So they are now, a couple of them are flowering. Am I actually perhaps going to get some tomatoes out of these volunteer crops?
Perhaps. Now, a lot of it depends upon what varieties you grew last year. So if you grew hybrids last year and then you have these little babies coming up, they're going to be a mishmash of all kinds of tomatoes. So they're not going to be the big beefsteak or the Brandywine or Cherokee Purple.
They're going to be my own.
They're going to be the Jane Lindholm
variety. That's
what
I'll name them. TM.
TM. They're mine.
Right.
So yes, you can let them grow. Now, the concern, of course, is that you have these volunteers in there and they can get disease on them and be more susceptible to disease and spread to your other plants. So keep an eye on them. But if you want to do a little science experiment, see what you get.
Cool. All right. I'm going to try to get some. That's very exciting. Let's go to Jean, who's calling in from Facetown. Hi, Jean.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Hi. What do you do about clubroot is the first question.
Mm-hmm. And is it on cabbage or cauliflower?
Yeah, broccoli. Collars and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah. So you want to look for, first of all, look at different varieties. When you're growing them, look for ones that are clubroot resistant or tolerance to clubroot. That will be your first line of defense for that. And then when you're growing these plants, you know, try to create an environment that's not going to be conducive to the clubroot, which is kind of a moist environment and a clay kind of soil. So raise the beds up, mix in a lot of compost. And of course, don't plant anything in that broccoli family in the same area for a good 3 years. You know, rotate your crops around. And hopefully you'll be able to break the disease cycle that way.
And Gene, you had another question?
Yes. Sometimes I have carrots that have like some black ring around it.
Around the carrot root itself?
Yeah.
Okay. And on the top of it or just in?
No, anywhere in the carrot part.
And does it rot or does it just have a discoloration?
No, it looks like some insect.
Oh, okay. I see. Some tunneling that's happened. Yeah, there's a carrot rust fly that you'll see will cause that damage. It's a little fly that lays its egg on the soil surface where the carrot is, and then it'll tunnel, it'll hatch, and then it'll tunnel like a little worm, a little caterpillar kind of around there and cause that damage. So the easiest thing to do with that, if you see that happening year after year, is to throw some floating row cover over your carrot crop. And that way, again, the fly can't lay the egg, and then you don't have the problem.
So speaking of carrots, Susan wrote in to ask, what variety of carrots should I plant for a fall crop of carrots, and when should I plant them in the Northeast Kingdom?
Oh, Northeast Kingdom? Last month, no.
Just joking.
No, you can be planting them anytime now, especially in the Northeast Kingdom. You probably wouldn't want to go much further into August. Once you get into August, it's going to be a pretty short period of time to get them to germinate and actually get any size carrots. As far as varieties, I would go for short season varieties, ones that are going to mature as quick as possible. There's some called short fingers, I think they are. I'm trying to remember the different variety names. Some of the different Nantes or Danvers carrots. Some of the ones that are just not going to be really long carrots, but more squat carrots that will mature fast enough so you can actually have a harvest.
And then do you just have to, I mean, do you get to the point where you might pick them a little bit smaller than you would otherwise
you
harvest
might.
Them?
So or you can do what I do, which is I mulch them really heavily and I just let them go through, some of them go through the winter. And then during the winter, I just pull that hay mulch over off of them and the ground usually isn't frozen, so I can just pull up my carrots as I need them.
It's okay. Like so you can let them go very fall, far
right
into
the
fall.
Spring, actually.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Paul's on the line with us from Richmond. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had two questions about fruit trees.
Okay.
Last year, I had a bumper crop of apples, peaches, and pears, and more than I ever had. And this year, they didn't blossom. And is that typical of fruit trees? With you have a bumper crop one year that maybe the next year they don't blossom?
Yeah, it's called alternate bearing. And it happens a lot on wild trees in particular, or trees that haven't been really pruned regularly and taken care of regularly. What happens is they almost look in terms of exhausting themselves, producing so much, and then they just don't produce flower buds for the next year. So the key to making sure that doesn't happen in your orchard is to make sure you prune them annually, taking out some of that growth, opening up the tree, and also making sure you keep them fertilized. So using some compost, using some organic granular fertilizers every spring, keep it nice and consistent. And then when you do have a big crop like last year, don't get suckered into this saying, I'm going to keep them all. Do some thinning. Thinning your apples and your peaches and your pears, thin them out so there's some space between the fruits. You get better quality fruits and you get fewer of them, but they'll be much better and you won't exhaust the tree so much because it's produced all this fruit.
Or if you're a homeowner, you just wait till you have a bumper crop, let it all happen, and then sell your house before the next spring so
that's
the new homeowners get none. That's the way I would do
it. Is that what you do?
Oh, yeah, sure. Why not?
Ooh, ruthless.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're talking about Machiavellian gardening here.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy's calling in from Greensboro. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is the second year we've had this problem. However, this year it is much, much worse. We are inundated with snails,
mm-hmm.
and they're all over the lawn, they're on all the plants, they're on trees, and of course they're on the garden. They get on the lettuce and Swiss chard, and they just wrap and then they reproduce. And so I've tried sprinkling some product that I bought at one of the lawn and garden stores to kill them,
mm-hmm.
but it's not working. And I didn't know if you had a suggestion.
Well, the product I use the active ingredient is iron phosphate. It goes by the trade names of Sluggo or Escargot. Kind of clever. And
no tea. Escargot.
Escargot. Exactly. And it's a little pellets that you just sprinkle around your lettuce or whatever plants that the snails and slugs are going after. And they have a slug attractant in it, so they eat it. And they, of course, eat the iron phosphate at the same time. And that's toxic to them, and it'll kill them. That's worked very well for me. And usually it withstands some rain, too, so you can leave it out there for a number of weeks. So that would be one thing that you might want to try. If you're doing anything on raised beds or containers, you might want to get some copper flashing, which is this copper strips that you can wrap around the container or put along the edge of the raised bed, the wooden or plastic raised beds that you have. The slugs and snails don't like crossing the copper because they have an electrical shock that's actually a chemical shock that happens when they cross it. So that will divert them and they'll go somewhere else.
Oh, very cool.
Nice.
Charlie, we have these shows frequently and, you know, you often have to give out the same type of advice because
mm-hmm.
we all have, you know, our own garden issues when we have them and we want
then
answers.
It's important.
Right. So how do you keep it fun? How do you keep it fresh for you?
Well, because every year is a little bit different and you're always always looking for kind of a little nuance here, a little something unusual, trying to grow a new plant or combating a new pest. And like we said earlier, I've got as many pests as anybody else. If you want to come over to my house, you can pick pests too.
Charlie Nardozzi is an expert gardener. He's also a garden consultant. He's host of the Vermont Garden Journal here on VPR on Friday evenings and Saturday mornings. And he's leading our garden tour of Barcelona and Provence in September. You can go to VPR.net for more information on all of those things. Charlie, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
It's great to be here.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about vaccinations. State Health Commissioner Dr. Harry Chen and Dr. Ann Chuckett of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will discuss Vermont's rates of vaccination and exemptions, and they're going to answer questions regarding the hesitancy some parents have about getting their children vaccinated. So if you do have questions, write to VermontEdition@vpr.net and then listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.